Welcome to the WGBH Forum Network weekly lecture series. From politics to poetry, science to satire, listen in and enjoy.
Hello, everyone. I'd like to welcome you all to the View from Africa tour. I would also like to be brief, as we have a full complement of readers tonight, and we're starting a bit late. The occasion for our coming together is the convergence of a number of what they used to call little magazines. My name is Mike Vasquez, and I'm the editor of Transition, a magazine started in East Africa in the 1960s and currently an official publication of the W.E.B. Du Bois Institute here at Harvard. You can learn more about us and our history by visiting our website, which is transitionmagazine.com. This tour, however, was the brainchild of Matt Beeland, a former editor of The Baffler, a magazine in Chicago from the 90s, now the deputy editor of Granta in the UK. For reasons that I'll get into in a moment, Granta has just published a special issue on Africa. Coincidentally, the Virginia Quarterly Review has a new issue with a focus on AIDS in Africa, as well as some fiction and nonfiction by younger African writers. Meanwhile, Transition has been publishing and championing work by the next generation of African literature for over a decade. It seemed like a great opportunity to team up. So here we are. I'm joined today by two of our contributing editors, Brett Hayes Edwards, professor of English and African American literature at Rutgers, and Sharifa Rhodes Pitts, a freelance writer, mostly of literary nonfiction. We are also joined by Binyavanga Wainaina, currently writer-in-residence at Union College in Schenectady, who really ought to be a contributing auditor. As it happens, they are three of my favorite people, and I'm delighted to welcome them all back to Harvard. Our first reader tonight is Binyavanga Wainaina. Binyavanga, or Binj, as he is known, might be the most influential writer in Africa today. He is, as you will discover, a fantastic reader, armed with one of the trillingest R's I have ever heard. He is also the dynamic center of Nairobi's incredibly vibrant literary scene. Having won the Kane Prize for African Literature in 2002, he used the cachet and the money from that award, the biggest in African literature, to launch the first major literary magazine in East Africa since Transition was shut down in 1968. Binge's magazine is called Kwani, with a question mark. The name means, so what, in Shang, the variant of Swahili spoken by young people in today's Nairobi. And Kwani is transforming, and in many cases creating, contemporary Kenyan culture, as well as introducing other young Kenyans to publishers in London, New York, and Cambridge. Fittingly, Binyavanga has stories in both Virginia Quarterly Review and Granta, as well as a number of pieces forthcoming in Transition. But today, slightly ironically, he's reading as an ambassador from Granta. The irony is that How to Write About Africa, his theme tonight, which you will hopefully recognize from the posters and postcards that were sent out, had its origin in an angry letter to the editor. 12 years ago, Granta did a special issue titled Africa, which was arguably full of weird crypto-racist Africana. A definite mood was created by the stories, which had titles like Startled in the Dark, The Lepers of Moyo, Death and Dirt, as well as A Child's Book of Death and Dying. And the roster of contributors spanned the full range of the European continent, from England to Ireland to France to Poland, with one American and one sub-Saharan African. Or two, if you counted the speech by Nelson Mandela, which Granta printed as a hopeful coda. The issue was roundly criticized at the time. But 12 years is an eternity in the world of magazines, and Binge only discovered the offending issue fairly recently. So the editors of today's Granta took his letter not as an affront, but as an opportunity. And so The View from Africa was born, a truly great document featuring works by many of the most interesting younger writers from the continent today, including, especially, Binyavanga.
Of course, the high cost of all of this was that then they got to publish the thing in the email rather than the thing I really wanted them to publish, which would have been some fiction, but c'est la vie. How to write about Africa. Always use the word Africa or darkness or safari in your title. Subtitles may include the word Zanzibar, Maasai, Zulu, Zambezi, Congo, Nile, Big, Sky, Shadow, Drum, Sun, or bygone. Also useful are the words such as gorillas, timeless, primordial, and tribal. Note that people means Africans who are not black, while the people means black Africans. Never have a picture of a well-adjusted African on the cover of your book, or in it, unless that African has won the Nobel Prize. An AK-47, prominent ribs, naked breasts, use these. If you must include an African, make sure you get one in Maasai or Zulu or Dogon dress. In your text, treat Africa as if it were one country. It is hot and dusty with rolling grasslands and huge herds of animals and tall, thin people who are starving. Or it is hot and steamy with very short people who eat primates. Don't get bogged down with precise descriptions. Africa is big, 54 countries, 900 million people who are too busy starving and dying and warring and emigrating to read your book. The continent is full of deserts, jungles, highlands, savannas, and many other things, but your reader doesn't care about all that. So keep your descriptions romantic and evocative and unparticular. Make sure you show how, taboo subjects, ordinary domestic scenes, love between Africans, unless a death is involved, references to African writers or intellectuals, mention of school-going children who are not suffering from yours, or Ebola fever, or female genital mutilation. Throughout the book, adopt a sotto voice in conspiracy with the reader and a sad, I expected so much tone. Establish early on that your liberalism is impeccable and mention near the beginning how much you love Africa, how you fell in love with the place and can't live without her. Africa is the only continent you can love. Take advantage of this. If you're a man, thrust yourself into her warm virgin forests. That was for Paul Theroux. If you're a woman, treat Africa as a man who wears a bush jacket and disappears off into the sunset. Africa is to be pitied, worshipped, or dominated. Whichever angle you take, be sure to leave the strong impression that without your intervention and your important book, Africa is doomed. Your African characters may include naked warriors, loyal servants, diviners and seers, ancient wise men living in hermetic splendor, or corrupt politicians, inept polygamous travel guides, and prostitutes you have slept with. The loyal servant always behaves like a seven-year-old and needs a firm hand. He's scared of snakes, good with children, and always involving you in his complex domestic dramas. The ancient wise man always comes from a noble tribe, not the money-grabbing tribes like the Gikuyu or the Igbo or the Shona. He has roomy eyes and he's close to the earth. The modern African is a fat man who steals and works in the visa office, refusing to give work permits to qualified Westerners who really care about Africa. He's an enemy of development, always using his good job to make it difficult for pragmatic and good-natured expats to set up NGOs or legal conservation areas. Or he's an Oxford-educated intellectual turned serial-killing politician in a Savile Row suit. He's a cannibal who likes crystal champagne, and his mother is a rich witch doctor who really runs the country. Among your characters, you must always include the starving African, who wanders the refugee camp nearly naked and waits for the benevolence of the West. Children have flies on their eyelids and pot bellies, and her breasts are flat and empty. She must look utterly helpless. She can have no past, no history. Such diversions ruin the dramatic moment. Moans are good. She must never say anything about herself in the dialogue except to speak of her unspeakable suffering. Also, be sure to include a warm and motherly woman who has a rolling laugh and who is concerned for your well-being. Just call her mama. Her children are all delinquent. These characters should buzz around your main hero, making him look good. Your hero can teach them, bathe them, feed them. He carries lots of babies and has seen death. Your hero is you, if reportage, or a beautiful, tragic international celebrity / aristocrat who now cares for animals, if fiction. Bad Western characters may include children of Tory cabinet ministers, Afrikaners, employees of the World Bank. When talking about exploitation by foreigners, mention the Chinese and Indian traders. Blame the West for Africa's situation, but don't be too specific. Broad brushstrokes are good. Avoid having the African characters laugh or struggle to educate their kids or just make do in mundane circumstances. Have them illuminate something about Europe or America in Africa. African characters should be colorful, exotic, larger than life, but empty inside, with no dialogue, no conflicts or resolutions in their stories, no depth or quirks to confuse the cause. Describe in detail naked breasts, young, old, conservative, recently raped, big, small, or mutilated genitals, or enhanced genitals, or any kind of genitals, and dead bodies, better naked dead bodies, and especially rotting naked dead bodies. Remember, any work you submit in which people look filthy and miserable will be referred to as the real Africa, and you want that on your dust jacket. Do not feel queasy about this. You are trying to help them get aid from the West. The biggest taboo in writing about Africa is to describe or show dead or suffering white people. Animals, on the other hand, must be treated as well-rounded, complex characters. They speak or grunt while tossing their manes proudly and have names, ambitions, and desires. They also have family values. See how lions teach their children? Elephants are caring and are good feminists or dignified patriarchs. So are gorillas. Never ever say anything negative about an elephant or a gorilla. Elephants may attack people's property, destroy their crops, or even kill them. Always take the side of the elephant. Big cats have public school accents. Hyenas are fair game and have vaguely Middle Eastern accents. Any short Africans who live in the jungle or desert may be portrayed with good humor, unless they're in conflict with an elephant or a chimpanzee or a gorilla, in which case they are pure evil. After celebrity activists and aid workers, conservationists are Africa's most important people. Do not offend them. You need them to invite you to their 30,000-acre game ranch or conservation area. And this is the only way you will get to interview the celebrity activist. Often a book cover with a heroic-looking conservationist on it works magic for sales. Anybody white, tanned, and wearing khaki who once had a pet antelope or a farm is a conservationist, one who is preserving Africa's rich heritage. Thank you.
Next is Brent Edwards, a scholar at Rutgers who is currently being courted by any number of universities, including this one. Brent is one of the most comprehensively knowledgeable people you are likely to meet. He is also one of the most generous, both of his time and his intellect. He sits on the editorial board of nearly every journal, even tangentially related to Africa and its diaspora, and has published in all of them. He is the editor or co-editor of several books, including collections on jazz, jazz studies, poetry, and black Marxism, and the author of the groundbreaking critical study, The Practice of Diaspora. Brent fell in with transition during his semester as a Du Bois fellow at Harvard, and he has been gracing our pages ever since. He wrote about surrealism and negritude, about making a back to Africa journey to Dakar, and then on the same trip doing time in a Senegalese jail, and about the full flowering of the late W.B. Du Bois. He has also translated a number of stories by African writers, sometimes in collaboration with his wife, Nora. He made a frightened sound once when I suggested that he was, in a sense, the intellectual conscience of transition, so I can't say that. But he is a treasured companion and trusted collaborator, and I'm happy to go on the record hoping that he'll join us here in Cambridge. Today, Brent is going to read from a brief selection of works, including his translation of a story by the Congolese magic surrealist Sony Labutansi from Transition 95. He'll also be reading from a piece that touches on the subject of his current project as a fellow at the New York Public Library, which deals with the politics of jazz in 1970s New York. And if I'm not mistaken, he's also going to read a poem. Brent Edwards.
Thank you. Can everybody hear me?
Yeah.
All right, the first, I am going to read short selections from three things. And the first is from an essay. There are also three things from three journals. The first is from an essay called Crossroads Republic, which is in the journal Chimurenga, which is, along with Benja's journal, one of the most important contemporary journals in Africa. It's published out of Cape Town. Unfortunately, Antone is not here to represent his journal, but I'm here to represent him. This is a piece about the trumpeter Lester Bowie, who is one of the founding members of the jazz group, the Art Ensemble of Chicago. In 1977, he goes famously to Nigeria and plays a few months in Fela's band, in Fela Kuti's band. Lester Bowie decided to go to Nigeria on something of a whim. at the end of May 1977, after performing with the Art Ensemble at the Moors Festival in Germany. He had enough money for a one-way plane ticket and about $100 in cash. Bowie had planned to support himself by playing any gigs he could find, as he had done when he lived in Jamaica for a number of months in 1975 and 1976. But he quickly discovered that he'd miscalculated the cost of living in Lagos. After the taxi from the airport, a meal, and a $50 room at the Hotel Babi, he didn't have enough money for the next night, and he didn't know anybody in Nigeria. And Nigeria, as he would tell one interviewer later, was really out. I thought, this is it, man. You've done it. Finally, you've bitten off more than you can chew. This is it. That night, he went up to one of the waiters in the hotel restaurant and attempted to explain his situation, saying that he was a musician and that he was looking for a place to play. The waiter gave him the once-over and said, you need to go see Fela. Bowie, who had never heard the name, responded eagerly, where does this guy live? The waiter smiled as he walked back into the kitchen and said, just get in any taxi and tell them to take you to Fela. Bowie found this advice somewhat dubious. To him, it sounded like getting in a cab in Manhattan and saying, take me to Miles' house. But with no other options, he decided to risk it. The next morning, he grabbed his horn and headed to the street. The first taxi driver he tried didn't seem at all surprised at the request and took Bowie to a hotel where, the driver said, Fela was staying with most of the members of the band. Wondering what he'd gotten himself into, Bowie stepped out of the taxi in the hotel courtyard and looked up at the building. The place was called the Crossroads Hotel. As he rode into the lobby, a short man came out and approached him. Hey, ma'am, what's that you got? Is that a horn? Is that a trumpet? When Bowie nodded, the man went on. Where are you from? New York. Do you play jazz? Asked the man. Yeah, I play jazz. Bowie considered whether to ask him about Fela. You must be heavy, then, the man commented. Well, you know, a little. Bowie smiled in spite of himself. The short man paused and then proclaimed in a conspirational stage whisper, listen, my friend, you've come to the right place. Why is that? The man looked around at the other people passing in the courtyard and explained, because we're the baddest band in Africa. They both laughed. It turned out that the short man was a guitarist in Fela's Africa 70. He took Bowie into the crossroads into the suite of rooms where the band was staying. It was 11 in the morning, but Fela was still asleep. Another musician disappeared into an adjoining room to wake him up. The curtains were drawn with only a thin crack of sunlight shining into the suite they'd entered, and the air was hot and cramped. As his eyes adjusted, Bowie realized that the modest space was almost impossibly cluttered with a dizzying array of items, trunks, suitcases, cardboard boxes, music instrument cases, half-empty bottles of cola and beer, food cartons, makeup, a few books, and great piles of multicolored fabric on what seemed to be mattresses distributed on almost every available inch of the floor. He realized that there were a surprising number of people in the room as well, men and women in various states of undress, most of them still sleeping. There was a slight but distinct scent of marijuana. A small, wiry man clad only in a pair of tight blue underwear emerged yawning from the other room and stared at Bowie in the half-light. Bowie stared back. Who's on duty? The man barked, and a woman appeared out of the layers and mattresses on the other side of the room and approached. She opened the curtains, and everyone in the room squinted at the sudden brightness. Some on the floor pulled covers over their heads or shielded their faces with their hands. A few sat up on their elbows to peer at Bowie. The wiry man came over to Bowie, stepping nimbly over the bodies on the floor, and shook his hand. You're Lester Bowie of the Chicago Art Ensemble, the man observed. Bowie assumed that this was Fela, although the man did not introduce himself. His body was taut and muscular, and up close, Bowie was taken aback to notice that the man was covered in a gruesome pattern of what seemed to be recent scars. Rows of thin slices on his shoulders, a welt that looked like a burn mark on his stomach. Ugly dark red dots from the tips of cigarettes along one of his forearms, a scab at the hairline. Around his neck he wore a cord with a clasp at the end to attach a saxophone and also a chain necklace of thin circular iron links from which hung a small bell the size of a walnut. Bowie began to explain his situation. He brought a few of his records, L'Estance à Sophie, Fast Lass, Baptism, as a sort of sonic curriculum vitae. No, no, Fela dismissed them, and turned to the woman who had opened the curtains, growling something in pidgin that Bowie didn't quite catch. She pulled a record out of one of the boxes near the window and brought it to a portable phonograph that was sitting on a low table in the middle of the room. Fela opened one of the black cases on the floor and brought out an alto saxophone, clipping it on and looking at Bowie with a sly smile that was almost confrontational. Let's play together, my brother, he said. Still standing near the door next to the guitar player, Bowie took his trumpet out. Strangely, it was easy to ignore the people lying around him on the floor. It was as though he and Fela were alone in the room. The record was a sort of music minus one compilation, a piano trio playing straightforward changes, a medium tempo blues. Bowie thought to himself, what the hell, and started to blow. Fela stood by the table and listened, licking a saxophone reed but making no move to play himself. When Bowie reached the turnaround on his second chorus, he heard Fela exclaim, stop, stop, hold it, that's enough. Bowie lowered his horn, and the woman lifted the needle off the record. That's enough, Fela repeated in a severe tone. Then he broke into a grin as he turned to the guitarist. Go get his bags, he's moving in with me. Now, shifting gears, I'm going to read just one section of a translation that was published in Transition 95 of Sonny Labutanzi's novel, it's L'État honteux, the State of Shame, about an African, one of the great novels about an African dictator. And this is the arrival of the dictator into the capital city. We came into the heart of the city on Highway 15. We crossed the Alberto Equezo Bridge and arrived at 4:45. At Del Panzo's, the people were dancing. He wanted to watch the dances, which didn't look at all like those of my tribe. But the Colonel Vasconi Mundiata approached from the road, thundering like a cannon. Stop this silliness! Can't you see this is the president? The Colonel Vasconi Mundiata was angry and started kicking the dancers. Five soldiers came to his assistance, dealing blows at random with their rifle butts. Then we saw the brow of the father of the nation cloud over. He signaled to National Carvanzo, who directed his horse toward the white horse so he could listen. Shoot these idiots. They're bothering the people. We applauded very loudly. For the first time, a president had acted in the name of the people. We marched over the corpses. Someone nearly dead on his feet cried out, ah, Mr. President, what a beautiful gesture. He kissed the national legs before keeling over. Give him 2 days of national mourning, said Lopez to my Colonel Carvanzo. We took him on a tour of the capital, Rue Valtaza, Rue d'Urbanzo, Rue Corbanzo, Grazzi Circle, the opera. We brought him to Vatni, the seat of power, the city hall, the national museum, the military encampments, the presidential port, the Place du Bichouin. At nightfall, we arrived at the palace. We led him through all the rooms, the weapons room, the gallery of diamonds, the hall of the comrades of the revolution, and the presidential vault, where only one of our 11 presidents rests in peace. The other 10, accused of high treason, lie in a mass grave. What is that? It's the map of the fatherland, Mr. President. Ah, of course. And what are those blue snakes? The rivers, Mr. President. Ah, of course. And those squiggles? The highways, Mr. President. And these other squiggles? The borders, Mr. President. For the first time, he held his sides and let out a great fatherly laugh. How could you be so stupid? You have neglected our national interest as much as those flamingos ever did. It's like white rule all over again. It's a goddamn shame. What are you, idiots? Find me some red ink. He raised his hand and drew the new dimensions of the fatherland. Put the soldiers to work. He drew four straight lines, joined at right angles. He gave part of our territory to our neighbors and took part of theirs for our own. This, my brothers and dear countrymen, is the decree of my hernia. The fatherland will be square. We cannot live in a funnel drawn by the colonizers. What kind of people are we anyway if we can't even make our own borders? The media supported this decree. That's right, get those soldiers marching instead of spending their life chasing after girls fed and clothed at public expense and then pull some shit where they take power for a yes or a no. With red ink, he signed the decision of my Palilalia, who sends all the soldiers to the border. Not a single one here, everybody to the border, because soldiers are made to shoot, old man. After this first televised message to the nation, he signaled to Carvanzo to approach. He took him by the shoulders, gave him two friendly taps. You will be my right hand. You will be the right arm of the National Mother. He lowered his voice a little to ask him, couldn't you, Mother, the life of a single man is hard. I'm thirsty. Find me a whore. Watch out for the press, Mr. President. Screw the press. I'm thirsty, and not a kid either. Kids have salt in their legs. He ate very quickly, drank almost nothing. He called for the maître d'hôtel to ask him why his meat was still bleeding. You think I'm a cat or something? No, Mr. President, this is the cuisine of civilization. So what makes you think I'm civilized, huh? Mr. President. Okay, you'd better get out of here if you cannot cook like we cook. We all applauded when he named his mother the national cook. National chef, Mr. President, said Carvanzo. Why? It is more beautiful, Mr. President. He repeated the word, and yes, it was more beautiful. And now I'm just going to read a short poem that's about to appear in the journal Callaloo, which is probably the most important diasporically inflected African-American journal. This poem is called Astral Caption, and it's part of a series of poems that are meant to be imaginary captions. It's a little bit that André Malraux idea of an imaginary museum, although the artworks are real. This is after an etching by Howardina Pindell, is one of the most important African-American printmakers. And the etching is called Cassiopeia Andromeda. Astral Caption. I write to snatch the light away the way the stars bleed white from the rims of their sockets, the faint afterflash of how many dark paths of departure. I write to intuit what trifles or looms beyond my vision, as a map is always a fanciful concatenation of what can't be known at once. Lavantil, Ouagadougou, Takoradi, Newark, Belém. The map is many maps, capped turrets and cannonballs spent, a charged symposium of gametes, dark bird tracks at dusk on a beach of volcanic sand, an archive of confused attack, index and cipher, sluice and retreat, a graveyard of chain links, uncoupled, tossed without ceremony, and hose dropped after digging, a blueprint of chutes and spires, glowworms trapped in tar. The stars migrate in tides of disarray. A constellation is a pack of incandescents traversing the plain. It is only susceptible to capture in the faint incisions it left as it came undone. I write to ask the copper what it saw. A needle point slicing beeswax, it whispers, goose down on my skin. How does the night share its secrets? Taunting, indirection, the fugitive's black craft. The stars have left us. And the astrologer, humble tailor, stitches a fit for a body that passed thousands of years ago. I write to constellate a leaving in a script only acid can read. Ink irrigates the furrows, and what gets hung? A window on the wall, a scribbled deposit of wounds.
Thanks, friends. Our final reader is Sharifa Rhodes Pitts, a current resident of Harlem. Sharifa introduced herself to me on the street almost 10 years ago. She was a Harvard freshman, and she instructed me that she would be interning at the magazine soon, and that she was very excited by the prospect. She proceeded to disappear for the next 4 years, resurfacing only at the end of her college career as the prodigal intern. What became clear in any case, and what has only grown more clear over the years, is that Sharifa has one of the most delicate yet unswerving literary voices I've ever encountered. You could say that she is a disarming admixture of Didion, Kincaid, Naipaul, and Rodriguez, but I think she'd be perfectly happy for you to know that she is from Texas, and that is important. After college, she bravely set out to make herself into a writer who could support herself by her writing. Now, 5 years later, she has sold 2 books to Little Brown Company. You can read more of her writing in the web archives of the New York Times, Nation, and the Women's Review of Books, among others. But I will argue that her finest moment heretofore is her dispatch, Lenox Terminal, an essay about Harlem history and being a girl, which appears in Transition 95, and which can also be found on the Transition website. Today, however, she is reading from a piece that will appear in our next issue, which I will now allow her to introduce for herself.
Hi. I have to sit down because I have a fear of falling over during the reading. Because this is a small excerpt from a very long essay that's pretty wide-ranging, I have to give a bit of an introduction. It's called Our Lady of Darfur, and it investigates the life of a Catholic saint named Josephine Bakita. She was born in Darfur, the region which just turned up on the cover of the New York Times again today after years of being there. And she died in Italy, and she lived for part of her life in Venice. I found out about her when I was in India, and a little Catholic girl gave me a votive image of this black saint without much information at all. I was told that she was a Negro, she was a saint. She was beaten 114 times, but she lived. That was the story I was given. So at some point, I wanted to learn more. Later, in talking with Mike one day, he was interested in doing a special section on the Sudan for a forthcoming issue of Transition. And somewhat jokingly, I said, oh, there's that saint from Darfur who lived in Venice. And he called me, we were emailing, and he called me and said, can you go to Venice this weekend? So I went a few days later. And this is a section of the essay that results. I didn't come to Venice with a guidebook, as I'd already decided to skip its greatest wonders. I knew I wouldn't have enough money for a gondola ride and had no stomach for Byron's Bridge of Sighs. The Basilica di San Marco, with its holy relics of St. Mark the Evangelist, looted from Alexandria by pirates, or rescued from there by patriots, depending on one's view of Rome, seemed somehow corollary to my purpose, yet I would not penetrate its facade. I'd resolved to stay out of the Palazzo Museums and the churches, skip the glassworks of Murano and the laceworks of Burano. Striking these from my traveler's itinerary left me with abundant free time in Venice. I spent my first morning there wandering the halls of the Institute, passing corridors and courtyards and cavernous sitting rooms, until I came to a small chapel that appeared to be in a state of suspended renovation, its cobwebbed rafters attesting to disuse. I stood there a while wondering if this was a place where Bakita herself would have prayed. As I left the chapel, quietly, as if expecting to be caught, I was startled by a nun, or Mike. She greeted me in Italian, which I immediately conveyed I did not speak. She continued anyway, motioning for me to join her on a nearby bench. The conversation that ensued was conducted on her part with smiles and gestures in Italian, while I expressed myself pronouncing Spanish words with an Italian accent, along with a handful of authentically Italian words and phrases. I learned that her name was Maria, and she learned that I had traveled from New York, that I was a journalist, and that I was in Venice to learn about the life of Josephine Bakita. Sister Maria seemed pleased with my answers. She patted my hands, which were neatly folded on my lap, and transmitted compliments on my dress and appearance. She proceeded to communicate familiar details from Bakita's life. She emphasized particularly and seemed especially impressed by the saint's experience as a slave. Even now I can hear in my head the way her voice grew emphatic. Schiavo, schiavo! As if her enunciation of this word in increasingly strident tones would convey, across the barrier of language, everything that was wretched about that condition. She carried on as if such a thing could hardly be fathomed, as if such a thing was itself a qualification for sainthood. When I was released from the interview, I made my way out of the convent onto a campo that faced the Grand Canal. On the other side of the Academia Bridge, I met an unlikely vision. It was not a shocking thing. It was something I might have seen back home in Harlem, a dark man in purple robes sitting on the stove pavement with an assortment of counterfeit handbags spread before him on a tarpaulin. The elegance of his clothing and his bearing only became evident when he rose to full height at my approach. He observed me with interest, returning my curiosity in kind, but he did not speak. We stood there contemplating each other at the foot of the Academia Bridge. There was a coldness in his manner that I didn't recognize from home. In New York, the presence of such a man selling such goods can be dismissed with a turning head and blinking eye, part of the city's migrant landscape. But in Venice, the garish aspect of his enterprise was heightened. He continued to look at me through narrowed eyes, as though finding me somehow objectionable. I wondered if it was something specific to my person, or whether his coldness might have been stemmed from some shame in my seeing him there with his vinyl goods laid out against the ancient stone of Venice. I wondered where he had come from, which quarter of the city was his home, whether he had a relative in New York. I wondered all these and more, but I didn't discover anything from him, for neither of us said a word beyond a customary, half-muttered ciao. Leaving that campo and its mysteries, I was squeezed into a crowded vaporetto, one of the water buses that course along the canal. It didn't take long for me to realize that I would spend my days in Venice on the water bus, alighting and embarking without any particular destination or purpose, partaking of the transcendent views of palazzos as seen from the water. I learned the ways of the vaporetto. I knew I was sitting next to a tourist if he or she wore sunglasses and pointed compulsively at the sights, whereas a Venetian would stare impassively, eyes fixed on no point in particular. It also seemed as if the Venetians emitted a distinct scent, difficult to place, but not unlike something I'd smelled in Harlem after a rain, when walking past a row of brownstones in need of renovation. After a few days in Venice, I thought I could smell it on myself. It derived, I realized, from washing with water, that it come from the sea. Surveying the graffiti that scarred the Rialto Bridge and the plastic water bottles floating along the canal, I began to think of Venice as some sort of watery grave, a memento mori for all civilizations. It often seemed on my walks that the most authentic artifacts of Venice were the wares sold by the African counterfeiters, or even the salesmen themselves. As I passed them, individually and in packs, their dark profiles thrown into relief against great marble facades only confirmed the continuity between these men and the ones immortalized throughout the gift shops in Venice, carved in wood as blackamoor statues, or wrought into the jewel-encrusted Moor's head pins available for sale in the expensive boutiques ringing the Piazza San Marco. I tried to guess what paths Josephine Bakita must have followed, which dock had introduced her to the city, which church she favored for going to mass. At the Cathedral of Santa Maria della Salute, a gift from Venice to itself after the plague of 1630 wiped out a third of its population, I stood before the dark-faced Madonna and lit candles, hoping they would conduct the prayers I could not make on my own, just as they might have carried Bakita's devotions. In the middle of a sudden rainstorm, I ducked into the Scuola Grande di San Rocco, named for the patron saint of pestilence. It is famous for having been decorated by the painter Tintoretto. When a 26-year-old Henry James visited, he lamented the place for its incurable blackness, referring to the dark scrim the centuries of grime and candle smoke have drawn across the canvases. Whether it was the darkness or some distortion introduced by the handheld mirrors by which one viewed the painted ceilings, they all seemed to depict a single and repeating catastrophe, an unremitting slaughter, though the signs claimed that the paintings depicted the great sweep of biblical history from Genesis to the rapture. There, too, I thought of Bakita, who might have used them as an aid in the study of her newfound religion. But there was only one place in Venice I could be sure Bakita had been. Not far from the cathedral was the Catechumenal Institute. In 1888, when the Venetian merchant and his wife, who owned Bakita, returned to Sudan on business, they deposited their slave and their daughter at the institute. The girls receive lessons in reading, writing, and religious instruction from the Silesian nuns there. One day, after lessons, the sister responsible for the girls asked Paquita, "Do you want to know God?" According to her official biographer, Paquita remembered the fascination she had had, even as a slave, with admiring the moon and the stars and the immensity of the desert. She had always wondered, who was the master of these things? The nun's question provided her with an answer. "Yes, yes," she is said to have cried out. I went to the Catechumenical Institute at the suggestion of the English-speaking administrator from the convent where I was staying. She gave me a map that showed the islands of Venice in the most elementary detail, with a circle around an otherwise unmarked location. The first time I visited the cathedral, I realized I was very near the designated spot on the map, and after a few turns, I arrived at a yellow stucco building with the character of a fortress. Walking its perimeter, I found nothing to confirm that I'd come to the correct place. There was a metal knocker on a door that I took to be the main entrance, but no one heeded my call. At the threshold, there was a hole in the wall where a doorbell might have been. Continuing along the building's edge, I came across a second door. I paused, either because the door was open or because the open door was blocked by a red and white striped barricade, the kind one might see at a crime scene or a construction site, or because beyond the barricade sat an easel, and the easel displayed a picture of Paquita. It was a poster-sized enlargement of the image from the votive card in my journal. I stood behind the barrier and looked into the room, which was a small chapel. Not long after Paquita arrived at this place, her fortune shifted once more. One day, the merchant's wife returned from Sudan to fetch her daughter and her slave and bring them back to Africa. A church pamphlet says this about what happened next. It was on that occasion that Paquita displayed singular strength of spirit and great faith. In fact, when confronted with the infection and economic security offered her by the Michieli family and the hope of rediscovering her family if she returned to Africa, she preferred God's love and abandonment to divine providence for her future, in which human terms was very uncertain. Thus she said with determination, "No, I cannot return to Africa because I would not be able to profess my faith in the Lord. I love the lady and her little girl very much, but I cannot lose my God, so I am remaining." Paquita's refusal to leave Italy sparked a controversy that involved the Cardinal of Venice and the procurator to the King of Italy. Both came to the conclusion that Paquita was a free woman. Accounts differ as to whether this was because slavery was illegal in Italy or because slavery was illegal even in Ottoman Sudan, where she had been captured, bought, and sold. But these accounts neglect to mention that the persistence of slavery across the Horn of Africa was one of the reasons used by Mussolini to justify his belated colonial excursions in Sudan's neighbor, Ethiopia. When I returned to the Catechumenical Institute the next day, the door to the barricaded chapel was closed. But at the main entrance where I'd been before, I'd seen no means of entry. I then found a modern intercom system. I rang the buzzer and was greeted by the sound of a door unlocking. In the lobby of the convent, I told the nun who greeted me that I was a journalist studying the life of Paquita in conjunction with what was currently happening in the place where she was born, that I wanted to visit the place where she lived while in Venice, the place where she had become a Christian. The nun seemed confused. She asked me repeatedly what it was I wanted there and appeared increasingly frustrated by my faulty command of her language. She called upstairs. A few minutes later, a small woman descended. From the way the two women interacted, I discerned that the second, smaller nun was the mother superior. I repeated my prepared testimony, but she looked at me equally blankly. Somehow I was able to convey that I wished to see that chapel, and the first nun agreed to take me there. We entered behind the altar near the poster-sized picture I'd seen from the street. I left the side of the impatient nun, drawn to the back of the room. A niche in the brick wall held a marble basin. I recognized it from one of the books as the font where Paquita had been baptized. The controversy that led to her manumission had made her a kind of celebrity, and on the day of her baptism, the tiny chapel had been filled with a crowd from every strata of Venetian society, women and men, gondoliers, people of the middle classes, people of the noble classes, and laborers. Before that motley assemblage, she was baptized by the same cardinal who had declared her free. Paquita professed her faith in God, renounced the devil and his works and vanity, and received her new name, Giuseppina Margherita e Fortunata. Standing at the baptismal font, crossing the small chapel back to the altar, I paused, expecting at any moment to be overcome by the feeling one sometimes gets when passing over sacred ground. I replayed in my head the scenario as narrated by the books. I populated the empty room with the varied Venetian onlookers. I conjured in my mind the image from the Catholic cartoon version of Paquita's life that portrayed her as a frail figure in white standing next to the cardinal in his pointy hat. At the altar, the nun began questioning me again. Che volto, meaning, what do you want? And capito, capito, meaning, do you understand? Strangely, I did understand her then. She lectured me on the folly of my expedition, insisting that although Paquita had lived in this place, it was much modernized and much modified and that there was nothing to see. The building was much different now, and I shouldn't have come. I tried explaining that it was very difficult to communicate what it was I wanted, but I stopped. It was very difficult to explain, but this had nothing to do with language. I did not feel overcome, which was not completely unsurprising, but I was completely unprepared for the feeling of dread that absence of feeling inspired in me. We stood there in the empty chapel in silence, contemplating my irreverence. When it became clear that nothing transcendent was occurring there, the nun led me out of the chapel.